this individual's quality of life is going to be in 15 to 20 years, right? At the game time, nobody else cares. But you have to be the one to think, you know, are they going to be able to play with their kids in their backyard in 10 years? Are they going to be able to get up and down the stairs in their house when they're 40? You know, what's their quality of life going to be if they need a total hip replacement?
Welcome to the NATA Cast, the official podcast of the National Athletic Trainers Association. The NATA Cast is your audio source for exclusive insight from NATA, our leadership, and athletic training thought leaders. This show will feature in-depth conversations about healthcare topics that interest you, the athletic trainer. Today's discussion is part of a special series titled Dedicated, in which we visit with ATs who have a passion for the profession. Whether it's in a leadership role, an AT who is making strides in research, or a member who is bringing increased awareness to the profession by working in an emerged setting. Dedicated highlights their stories and path as they advance athletic training.
Hello, welcome to the Dedicated podcast series. I'm your host, Katie Scott. I'm a certified athletic trainer and senior special projects coordinator at NATA. Today's guest is NATA incoming District 7 Board of Director, Valerie Herzog. Valerie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Katie.
So, Valerie, you are the new District 7 director. What drove you or what motivated you to want to put your name into the hat to be a district director? Not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. So, you know, I've served in several different leadership positions and I've always just had a great time, honestly. I mean, it's work, obviously. But I really enjoy feeling like I'm making a difference and helping to move the needle and move our profession forward. As an educator, I kind of feel a responsibility to do it because I want to make sure that all these students that I'm recruiting and educating and sending out into the workforce can get good paying jobs and find satisfaction in their careers. And so that's always been really motivating to me.
So take me back to the beginning. How did you first get exposed to athletic training?
That is a great question. So I played soccer in high school, and we actually didn't have an athletic trainer. And when there were injuries on the field, I kind of just became the AT for the team. So I was taking care of other girls and, you know, just figuring stuff out when I could. And then in my junior year, I developed stress fractures in my feet, in my metatarsals across both feet. And I told my parents, I said, I think I need to see an orthopedist. I said, I feel like my feet are broken. And they said, what do you mean your feet are broken? And I said, I feel like I have broken bones in my feet. That's what it feels like. And so they took me to see an orthopedist and he said, yep, you've got stress fractures in both feet. Mm-hmm. And I was 16 and I wanted to play. So I said, well, that's not a real fracture, right? So can I play? And he said, yeah, just take these painkillers. So for 2 years, I played on some pretty heavy pain meds. And because of that, I played even rougher. I was already a really physical player, but because it didn't hurt to hit somebody or to get hit. And so, you know, but I had to start every day with, you know, a handful of painkillers to get out of bed. And that's how I played for the next 2 years. And my shin guards were soaked with blood. And one day I had a concussion. At the end of the game, I actually lost the ability to speak for about 3 hours. Like, I knew what I wanted to say, but I couldn't make words come out. So that might explain some things for those of you who know me. But I told my parents, I said, I think something's wrong, once I could finally talk. And my dad just said, oh, just go to bed. You'll be fine. So I did. I just, you know, went to bed, got up in the morning, took a handful of painkillers and went back to soccer. And so I did that for 2 years and it was hard. Like, I love soccer and I love playing, but I was tired of being in pain all the time. And that's why I decided not to play college soccer. And I thought, you know, as I learned more about my injuries, and I think the telling thing my senior year, there was a girl who showed up to practice and on crutches. And my coach said, oh, you should go talk to her. And I said, okay. And I said, what's going on? And she said, oh, I have a stress fracture in my foot. And I was like, oh. And I remember thinking about it. I'm like, your doctor put you on crutches and mine just gave me painkillers and told me to keep playing. Now, what's wrong with this picture? So I thought, you know, I just thought somebody needs to look out for these athletes and take care of them. And I still have, you know, I have arthritis in both my feet and I've seen a doctor now. And I said, all we can do is, you know, fuse all the bones in your feet together. And I had chronic headaches for 15 years. And, you know, it's just, it's not worth it.
So having gone through all of that, I mean, that's an incredible story. And as an athletic trainer as well, I mean, I know we're on a podcast, but you saw my eyes were like so big because I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. How has that influenced the way that you teach your students to clinically practice?
Oh, huge, right? So I share that story with my students and I tell them, I'm like, somebody has to care about what this individual's quality of life is going to be in 15 to 20 years, right? At the game time, nobody else cares. All they care about is that game and that day. And in all their minds, I mean, honestly, that is the most important thing to them at that time. But you have to be the one to think, you know, are they going to be able to play with their kids in their backyard in 10 years? Are they going to be able to get up and down the stairs in their house when they're 40? You know, what's their quality of life going to be if they need a total hip replacement at 50? That's what I'm getting this summer. You know, it's just, it matters, you know. And another story I share with them is actually, if you watch Keisha Harrell's, she did a video for University of Miami. It's really powerful. And she talks about asking them, what's most important to you? And I had a basketball player one time who had his shoulder kept dislocating, right? He had subluxed, he could pop it back in. And we were trying to just get him through the season and then have the reconstruction at the end of the season. And I was kind of letting it be his call because it had come out for years. And so he came in one day and he said, I'm done. I want the surgery now. And I said, oh, okay. What changed your mind? And he said, I picked up my daughter and I almost dropped her. You know, and so we just forget that he's not just a basketball player, right? He's a dad, he's a husband, you know, and their lives matter. And it's not just about basketball. It's not just about soccer. You look back and you think, oh yeah, that was a really important game. But you know, now I'm thinking back when I was 16, I'm like, who are we even playing? You know, I mean, in the heat of the moment, it's the most important thing, right? But even 10 years later, you're like, was it really that important?
Absolutely. We'll make sure to link the webinar you just talked about in our show notes too, so that the listeners can go back and watch that, because I've not seen it, but I'm definitely very interested in.
Oh, it's great. It's super powerful.
Awesome. So Valerie, looking then through athletic training, you've graduated, you've become certified. You talk about your clinical experience. When did teaching become a passion for you?
So, my first kind of real job, I was working at a high school. It was a boarding school in Virginia. And they had asked me to teach a class. And I thought, okay, I don't really want to teach, you know. And I can even back up further. So in high school, I was tutoring some of my classmates in calculus. And my teacher said, you should be a teacher. You're really good at this. And I was like, I don't want to be a teacher. And then, you know, in college, I was tutoring kids in chemistry and algebra, and somebody said, you should be a teacher. I'm like, I don't be a teacher. I even turned down a teaching scholarship for college that I got offered to go to Rutgers. And I was like, no. And then, so I get this job at the high school and they say, we need to teach a sports medicine class. And I was like, all right. And then I'm like, wow, I really love this. I really enjoy doing it. And then, so I was there 2 years and then I went and got my master's at UVA. And they had us teach a Sunday seminar to the undergrad students. And it was kind of fun. And then, you know, again, a professor pulled me aside and said, I think you're kind of natural. You should think about teaching. And I'm like, I do not want to teach. And then I got a job at University of Charleston and it was a Division II, so kind of a split position. So teaching a couple classes in the morning and being the athletic trainer in the afternoon. And I really enjoyed doing a little bit of both and having some variety in my day. And then I was there 5 years and I just noticed as the years went on that I was getting a lot more joy out of the classroom time than I was on the athletic training side. And I still enjoy being an athletic trainer, but I was really getting my energy and my joy from teaching. And so I decided to go back and get my doctoral degree and teach full time. And I love it. And I still, you know, do some athletic training here and there. We fill in, the faculty here, we take turns being spotters at home football games. And if the staff are in a pinch, they'll give us a call and we'll cover stuff for them. And I take care of people. I love when I'll have another faculty member. I was even taking care of one of our provosts a few years ago and just like having a real patient to work on. It's kind of fun.
It is a lot of fun. What advice do you have for a young athletic trainer who's thinking about going into higher education for their setting?
So even though I kind of took a roundabout path to get here, I do think it's important to get some real experience before your doctoral degree or during. I think that the stories that I'm able to tell in class to reinforce what they're learning really have an impact. And there's some things that I, you know, like I teach rectal thermometry for heat stroke now, and I've never actually done that. So it doesn't mean you have to have done everything. But I do think the stories, you know, like the basketball player I told you about, I do think it's impactful with the students. And it helps drive home like what's really important. And sometimes I can even show them, like when we're doing a Lachman's, and I'm like, okay, you know, I know this is how the book shows you to do it, but you know, I have small hands, and most people have, athletes have really big thighs, and I can't get my hand around, and I'm not strong enough. So this is how I do it, you know, especially when I'm working with a bigger football player. And I think that really makes a difference to share some real world experience. But it's super rewarding career. I love it.
I would totally agree. At one point in my career, I took a pause to think about going into higher education. I was a teaching assistant as part of my graduate assistantship. And so it was very rewarding and interesting to me. But what seemed to be a little bit murkier is not so much the pathway to the professional degree or the post-professional programs, but that whole concept of looking for programs to match your doctoral pathway. And so yeah. As people have made the decision to go into higher ed and they're now seeking that terminal degree, what advice do you have for them as they're searching programs, and what kind of things should they be looking for a program?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I tell them to think about is what kind of job do you want to get, right? So I'm at Weber State and I love it. You know, we do research, our students all do a master's thesis. So I have a lot of research going on all the time. But the research expectation at Weber State is pretty low, right? So to get tenure, you know, 1 to 2 publications in 6 years. So I can do research. I have the freedom to do what I want. I don't have to develop this super focused research line. And I have work-life balance, right? I don't make as much money as they do at a big research one. So I tell students, if that's a job that interests you, you know, then you could do an EdD or a PhD, and it doesn't, you know, there's not, doesn't matter so much as to what you get it in, right? But if you really want one of those big time research one faculty jobs, University of Utah, University of Kentucky, Pitt, you know, UNC Chapel Hill, those big schools, then you need to get a research PhD and you need a focus line of research, right? So that's going to steer you to a particular program. So the first thing you have to do is figure out, well, what area of research do I want to do, right? And then you have to get into the literature, and then you have to see who are the faculty who are publishing in that area. And then you need to reach out to them and look at their doctoral programs and see if they're at a school that has a doctoral program. And then reach out to the faculty member and say, are you taking any doctoral students, or when do you think you'll have another opening? Go to the convention. I always say go to NATA and find out when they're presenting. Go listen to their presentation, shake hands after, you know, make a face-to-face connection and say, hey, I'm the one that reached out to you. Because in those positions, I think people don't realize, for those big PhD roles, you don't just apply. You have to establish a relationship with a faculty member. You know, they put all the applications on the table, and this faculty member says, I can take 2 students this year, and I'm going to take this one and that one. And it's not a flat ranking, right? It's, they're going to pick the students they've established a relationship with, who they know they want to do research together with. And you can have the best application on the table, but if that faculty member hasn't ever spoken to you, they're not going to pick up your file and take you on.
Building relationships is super key.
Yeah. And there are some schools where, you know, maybe a DAT would be accepted. They did a research study a while ago to see, you know, if employers would consider hiring someone with a DAT. And at Weber State, for example, we have 5 full-time faculty. One of the faculty lines is an instructor line. So for that one line, we would accept a DAT, but not for any of the other lines. And that's not a tenure track line. So the DAT, I always say use caution, because there are some, you know, there's some universities like ours, right, that would take a DAT, but again, only for one of the lines if that line opens up. And there are some other institutions will accept the DAT and potentially even as a tenure track role. But your opportunities and your choices are diminished significantly, right? So it's a much narrow focus, much more. If you really want to be a full-time faculty member and that's your dream, I would recommend the EdD or PhD. And again, you have to decide, you know, what career path do you want? And, you know, if you do the PhD, if you do a research PhD, you could still choose to come to a place like Weber State, right? And have more work-life balance. So that keeps all the doors open. If you do an EdD, you have fewer options, right? If you do the DAT, you have even fewer options, especially now. I mean, I think about 100 programs have closed. So there are, fewer faculty lines, although, you know, some are adding faculty lines because by fall of 23, with the Katie standards, they have to have 3 full-time faculty. So, but I think it's a competitive job market right now. So
no, it's about who you know, going back to building relationships.
Right. Exactly. Well, the faculty member, you know, it's they want to take on a student who really wants to work with them, has some experience and is interested in their line of research. And, you know, they're just not going to take a chance on somebody they never talked to.
Speaking of research, there's a lot of new research coming out. Part of my role on staff is actually overseeing our research survey service. So it's always really cool to see the students engaging in research. What topics would you like to see starting to get published more in the JAT and ATEJ?
You know, I think we need more rehab research, mm-hmm. honestly.
Like clinical outcomes and things.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's tricky. I think a lot of times in rehab and modalities research, we do a single treatment, right? So mm-hmm. we do a stretching technique and we say, how does that increase range of motion? Or we use a single modality or a single manual therapy technique. But the reality is, I mean, you're an athletic trainer, you know, we never treat an athlete with one thing, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so absolutely. I think we need to compare program A to program B. And maybe there's something, a single thing that's distinct about it or some things that are different. But, you know, even like some of the studies that have been done with swelling, right? They say, well, you know, we did this compression pump on them and we did it 30 minutes, 3 times a week. And, you know, it didn't make their swelling any better. And it's like, we never would just do that.
Right.
In clinical practice, we would never just treat them 30 minutes, 3 times a week and not do anything else, right? Mm-hmm. We would ice them. We might massage the swelling out. We would probably have them leave in a compression bandage of some sort. And then we tell them to go home and keep it elevated, right? We would never just treat them with intermittent compression for 30 minutes and then send them on their way. And so I think we need to do more realistic studies where we do the whole program, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then we see how that impacts swelling. Or, you know, we do a whole rehabilitation program and we compare program A to program B and really see what makes a difference. And I know it's harder because from a research standpoint, you know, you need to know which part of the program is effective and which one's not.
Right. It's got more variables in it to have to monitor.
Right. I think the other thing we need to do, and I just published a study on this, is we need to think about our patient population more. So I did a survey. We surveyed all of the published researchers for the last 5 years in 3 leading sports medicine journals, including the JAT. And we asked them, you know, what would you do? Let's say you're doing a research study on ankle instability and you have an athlete or a patient show up, somebody who'd like to volunteer to be in the study, and they say, I'm transgender. Or I'm intersex. And you're like, oh, what do I let them be in the study? If so, what do I do with their data? And I'll tell you, there are still no national guidelines. NIH has no guidance. One of the last questions I asked in the survey was, does your university have any guidance about this? And most said no, or they don't know. Or they have some general statement like you should be inclusive and include everybody, but they don't really talk about how to deal with somebody who's transgender, especially if they're taking hormones or using surgery to transition to their gender identity. And so what most researchers do, and not just in athletic training, but in all medical research, is they just exclude that individual. They just say, we're not going to include you in our study. It's too messy, right? Because we wanted 20 males and 20 females and 10 of each in each group. And that makes our study and our stats really nice and clean.
Yeah, but that's right? So hard because then we're missing out on important data and outcomes measures to be able to better our clinical care of those that population.
Well, and this is a huge issue for women. I think I read a stat, 60 to 80% of women at some point in their life will take hormones, whether it's birth control or dealing with menopause or for other issues. Mm-hmm. And most clinical research studies out there in the medical world exclude anybody taking hormones. So we've got the majority of women at some point in their life taking hormones, and we have no idea how these treatments will affect them while taking hormones. You know, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. Like the worldwide, even with like AIDS research, women are more likely to have AIDS worldwide, and they're most likely to be excluded from AIDS research.
So with the hormones, is it more about, again, just the variability and the outcome of the data? Or is it the IRB feels like that's considered an at-risk factor for injury or harm?
I'm sure it depends on the type of research study, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, fine. So try out on a low dose. You know, my brother does stem cell research. They're actually reversing spinal cord damage. It's amazing. But, you know, they were worried about if he did stem cells in somebody, would it cause cancer? So they had to start their first trial with a really low dose, you know, and they did it on a set of patients to see if there were any adverse effects. They didn't have any positive effects because it was such a low dose, right? And then over time, they gradually increased the dose with different cohorts and different studies. So, but they didn't just say, well, it might be dangerous, we're not going to do it. I mean, there's other ways to go to get around that. You know,
absolutely.
But it takes time and intention.
So you and I are having great conversations about athletic training, clinical research, which is great. This is one of my favorite topics just to geek out on from time to time.
Me too.
And we've talked about really important topics. I love the idea of the comprehensive studies of rehabilitative programs. For students, though, that are interested in maybe just dipping their toe in the water and seeing what the research process is all about, any advice to them as they get started?
Okay, so I'm going to be very self-promoting here, but I would say pick a program like Weber State. We're one of the few that actually still does a research thesis as part of the master's degree, our professional master's.
And what a great experience. I did a research thesis for my master's, and it was intense and long, but I think that honestly is what gave me the passion that I have now for the topic.
Yeah. I agree. I think research can seem really scary and you have no idea what to do. But once you get into it, students really get excited about it.
It's the statistics class, I think. It's probably the statistics class.
Yeah, stats are scary. But there's so much more help now. You know, we steer our students. Actually, there's a website called Laird Statistics. It's LAERD Statistics. Okay. And for SPSS, you put in, it helps you think through what is the right stat. You know, it's like, do you have this kind of variable or that kind of variable? And you're like, I don't know what that means. And so then it gives you 10 examples of each. You go, oh yeah, my data looks like that. I have that kind of variable. So it helps you choose a stat through a flowchart, you know, algorithm. And then when you're like, okay, I know I'm going to do a repeated measure ANOVA. You click on repeated measure ANOVA. It explains the stat. It walks you through every single step with, as you know, SPSS screenshots. Okay, now you see this. Now move this into this box. Then when you get your findings, it tells you, okay, look in this box. And then here's the answer, right? And then here's what this means. And then it even tells you, and here's how to write it.
Wow.
Here's how to write the sentence. I mean, it's amazing. So stats are less scary, I think, than they used to be because there's more help out there. But one thing we do in our program too is we have a lot of structure around the thesis. So there's structure to it every semester to help guide students through the process. We also let our students do group projects, which is really nice. So each student in the project will have their own dependent variable, so their own slice of the project. Mm-hmm. But we'll give them their own topics. So they'll write their own lit review on their specific topic. Then they'll come together for methods and data collection so we can do more subjects and they've got a team to work with. And then we split up the data. So this student gets active range of motion and this student might get the passive range of motion measurements, right? And then they run their own stats, they do their own results, their own discussion. But I think, you know, finding a program, whether it's in a doctoral program or a master's program, where there's going to be structure and mentorship is really important. Research is scary if you just kind of get thrown to the wolves. You know, it's like, okay, go do a study. And there's just a lot to it, right?
Absolutely. And we're not even getting into the grant writing process, which in itself is an entirely different beast.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things, we have some funding here at Weber. So we have about $1,000 for each student to actually conduct their research. So if they work in a team, you know, team of three, they have $3,000. And then if they get accepted to present at NATA or at a district conference, we actually pay for their travel too. So we put some funding behind it as well. So it's exciting, right?
Oh, absolutely. And we'll make sure to link a lot of show notes for resources. So we'll talk about the research survey service that NATA offers. There is, for certified professionals that are becoming professional researchers, there's the NATA Foundation Mentor Program as well. Research Mentor Program we'll link to. It's just a really exciting time, I think, to be in the research realm for athletic training because there's just so much changing and coming out. So.
Oh, yeah. And we had two student teams get accepted to present last year.
Okay.
I was really nervous because they did away with the student exchange track, which is where we would usually steer our students to. And now that's gone. So they have to compete in the peer review track against, you know, researchers at Research One and doctoral students. And both of my groups got accepted last year and presented at NETA. And
it's incredible.
My two groups submit this year. So fingers crossed that they'll get in again. But it's a great experience for them and they do get excited about it.
So Valerie, this has been phenomenal. You and I could probably talk about research all day and I might hold you to that as I see you more in the future, but switching tracks to volunteer and leadership, as you were going down your pathway to today, what was your first role in leadership? Was it in athletic training?
That's a good question. Not exactly. Well, I guess. I mean, I told you about the high school I worked at, so I was a head athletic trainer. So I consider that to be certainly a leadership role.
Absolutely.
Then I got my master's degree, and then I was working at the Division II school, University of Charleston. And I was really trying to get involved in the West Virginia Athletic Trainer Association, and I wanted to get involved in advocacy. And I kept stepping forward and saying, I could do that. And I'd be on the committee. They said, oh, we need committee volunteers. So I'd go up and shake a hand and give a card and say, oh, I'd love to be on that committee. And then I didn't hear anything. And I did it again the next year and didn't hear anything. And then I finally just kept throwing my name in the hat. And finally, I got involved. And I think a lot of athletic trainers get frustrated and give up.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Right. But I didn't. And I never have. You know, even when I apply for jobs, I'm always the one calling and following up. And I don't think anyone has ever chased me down. And so that's always my advice. So I would just say, don't give up. I think a lot of athletic trainers, they volunteer and they don't get selected. And then they just say, well, I tried and I quit, or, you know, but it was several years before I finally got invited. And then once you get that opportunity, then, you know, do the work, right? Come prepared to the meetings, do what they ask you to do. It's usually not that much work, but show up on time to the meetings, be there. And then if you do a good job in the first opportunity you get, whatever that is, the doors just fly open.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Because mm-hmm. then they know that you're somebody that can, you know, will do the work and is a good team player and friendly and somebody that, you know, other people want to work with. And then all of a sudden you get so many opportunities, you don't know what to do with them. And then your friend gives you a set of post-its like this. I don't know if you can see it, but it says, please stop me before I volunteer again. She said, you need to stop. But, you know, you start getting offered so many fun things and you're like, oh, yes, that sounds great. That sounds great. Before you know it, you're doing too much. And so that's what I've done. The second part of my career is like, I've got to step back. And is one thing I've realized too, you know, for every athletic trainer or individual who's doing four or five leadership roles, well, that's a lot of people that don't get to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I've tried to look at it that way. It's not that I'm declining something where somebody needs me. It's like, no, let's try to bring somebody else in. Right. Because if we're doing too much, probably not doing a good job either. Right. Because you don't have time, you get overloaded. So,
yeah. And that's something actually that this year have really tried to look into is it's not so much that you're finding a way to say yes, but it's where can you put your most investment of time in? Because if you say yes to 20 things, that investment of time is less. Right. So right. Where can you be most, where's the largest sum of ROI back to you with the time committed?
Right. And let's share the leadership opportunities with others. Let's bring in some new people. We tend to just, you know, like I said, if you do a good job, they're like, okay, great. Katie's a good worker. We want Katie. And they keep coming back to Katie. And so you have to say, well, what about Jennifer over here? Jennifer would be good too. How about I mentor Jennifer and bring her in? Right. And then you share the workload and you raise another leader up, right?
Raise another leader, grow your network. People start coming to you then because you become the network connector, which mm-hmm. is, I think, just as fun as doing the work, right? Because then you're not doing as much work, but you're able to connect right. the people.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. We need to work hard to bring in more people.
So Valerie, when, at what point did district director hit your radar?
You know, I've kind of always wanted to do it, honestly. I just kind of think it's kind of the pinnacle of AT leadership, in my opinion, you know, where I feel like I can really have the biggest impact. And like I said, I've always really wanted to make a difference, especially when it comes to advocacy. And NETA is really the lead driver in the advocacy world. So, you know, I've just been kind of waiting to see when, and, you know, the opening only comes every 5 years, right? In our district, I think in most, but it's changed around quite a bit. So it was a good time for me. I had the bandwidth to do it and there was an opening and I thought, I'm just going to go for it. And, you know, I went to a leadership conference years ago called HERS. It's a 2-week residential leadership program for women in higher education. And it was really impactful. And one of the things I learned there that I really brought back is men will apply for a job or a leadership role when they meet about half of the qualifications. And women will typically wait until they meet about 90% of the qualifications. So until we're fully qualified, we won't go for it. But men will just throw it in and be like, oh, I'll figure it out when I get there. And I thought, darn it, I'm just going to start throwing my name in the hat. So I threw my name in the hat for associate provost a few years ago, and I didn't get it. That's okay. But, you know, immediately after, I had a dean reach out to me and say, hey, you had a really great application. You're not quite ready. I'd be happy to mentor you. I was like, awesome. You know, and then I threw my name in the hat for Utah House of Representatives and ran for office. And again, I didn't win the election. It was a special election because the representative had passed away, unfortunately. So there were 9 of us in the pool, and I ended up 2nd out of 9 candidates. I was like, sweet, you know, and that grew my network just talking to people. And so I've just, you don't always win, but it's kind of an adventure. And, it's always disappointing to not get picked. But I look back on it, and I'm always glad when I did it. I threw my name in the hat and see what happens. So, you know, the district director position opened up, and I said, what the heck? I'll throw my name in the hat and see what happens, you know? And if I get it, it'll be awesome. And if I don't, then I'll keep my eye out for the next opportunity. And I think sometimes we're just so focused on one path. And if that path doesn't work out, we're crushed. But I have like 100 things I want to do, right? So if this one doesn't work out, if I didn't get elected for district director, I already kind of knew what I'd go for next. And that's okay. And it makes it, I don't know, more bearable.
Do you see in the future running for a representative position again?
Maybe. We'll see. I think, you know, campaigning takes a lot of time.
It does.
And so I think when I retire, I might run again. It's hard to, you know, I already have a full-time job. So picking up another full-time job, I realize it's just, when I didn't win, I was like, what the heck was I thinking? I don't have time for that.
What a crash course on steroids, though, and the importance of networking and community building, because I mean, that had to have just been incredibly intense, but probably a really cool experience. You're the first trainer I've actually talked to. I've heard of ATs running for office, but I think you are the first actual person that has run that I know.
Oh, well, I know there's a couple who have served for sure. I mean, we've had quite a few who've served. And Jerry Crummell, he's our district rep on the NATA GAC. And mm-hmm. He served for a while, I think in Washington, but now he's back in our district. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just think it's like, oh, should I? Shouldn't I? Just do it. Just do it. See what happens, you know? And yeah, by losing, I met so many people and people know my name and they're like, wow. And I've even had people come up to me and say, I really wish you would have run. You were my top candidate. And I'm like, thank you. That's really kind. And it's never a bad thing, you know? And if nothing else, I learn from it. So if I do run again, I know exactly what I'll do a little bit differently. You know, I'll know what it takes. And if I ever run for associate, throw my name in the hat for associate provost again or dean, you know, I've been through the process now, so it's not so scary. I got a dry run. So yeah, I'm really excited. You know, the other reason I really wanted to be on the district directors, and I know this is kind of a strange thing to say, but Kathy and I were on the Katy board together on the commission, and we developed a really good relationship there. And I always knew her tangentially, you know, I'd go to see her speak and we'd chit chat a little bit here and there, but we were on the Katy commission together. We really got to know each other really well. And when she was elected NATA president, I thought, now there's somebody I could work under. You know, I so respect her as a leader, and I really love her as a person. And so I thought, oh, here's a district director role that's open and I would get to work under Kathy. That would be amazing. So that was really motivating for me because it makes a difference to work under somebody you really respect and admire.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. Speaking of President Derringer, she has kind of made it part of her mission as president with the quote, I'm going to leave the profession better than I found it. So taking on the role as district director in June, and then you have 3 to 5 years to make an impact. How do you plan on leaving the profession better than you found it when you finish your term as district director?
Yeah. So, you know, advocacy is kind of my jam. It's one of the reasons I ran for office. but I love advocacy. I love it and I hate it, right? It's hard work. It's frustrating. You know, I tell people it's, you know, when you're trying to run a bill, I've been running bills for 20 years now. And I say, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And then I started saying, it's not actually a marathon. It's more like one of those Spartan races where you're crawling through the mud and people are trying to beat you down with a stick. And, you know, but then you get to the finish and you're covered in mud and you're like, yes. You know, no, I've never done one. I know people who've done that, but that's kind of what I think it feels like. But
it is. I've done one and I can confirm it absolutely is.
I have never done, but I know people who have, right? So, you know, really my goal is to get more people involved in advocacy efforts. And I think people think it's scary, like, oh, I'm not going to call my legislator, but they're just a person. They're just a person like you are. They're just a human being, right? They put on their pants one leg at a time, just like you do, right? They have to go to the bathroom and eat breakfast in the morning. They're just normal humans. And so you have to break down that wall and then show them ways they can get involved in advocacy that's maybe not so scary. It's like, well, can you send an email? Can you write a letter? Could you maybe invite them to a football game? You know, oh, yeah, I could do that. And, you know, would you be willing to put a campaign sign in your yard? And I think if we could get more athletic trainers getting to know their legislators and advocating on behalf of the profession, we could make a huge difference.
Well, and I think what people need to understand is they actually really enjoy new constituents making connections with them. They thrive off of that because it gives them more confidence knowing that the decisions they make really are representative of the people they serve. Right. So I've never had a bad experience reaching out to representatives. Sometimes it takes longer than your normal conversation, right? Like sometimes you're calling a couple times, but for the most part, I mean, I've never had nothing but a positive experience and almost a thankfulness. Like, thank you. We've never heard from you before. This is great.
Yeah. Well, and taking the opportunity to educate them. If you think about like the Utah legislative session is 45 days, and that includes Saturdays and Sundays when they're not actually in session. So they're actually only in session for 37 days. Mm-hmm. And they have tons of bills coming across their desk. And even if you think about Congress or any state, how many bills and the different types of bills. So imagine you're a legislator and within a single day, you have to vote on bills related to healthcare, prisons, transportation, the environment, higher education, public education. You know, I mean, like, who can know everything about all these bills, right? And so lobbyists get a bad name, but they kind of lean on lobbyists to say, okay, what are the pros and cons of this bill? What would be the impact of this bill? And so they lean on lobbyists because what they don't have is they don't have enough of us educating them. And so they love it when we come and we say, here's why you should vote for this bill. Here are the positive implications if you voted for that bill. Here's the downside of not voting for that bill. Or here's why you should vote that bill down. Mm-hmm. They say, thank you. I mean, because they need to be educated. And they just, like in Utah, they don't have any paid staff. You know, in Congress, they have teams of paid staff that do all this research and provide it to them. But in most states, I mean, our legislators, even in the Senate, they have one unpaid student intern who's new every year.
Wow.
Right. They really rely on public citizens to come and educate them. And so I think if you come at it from that standpoint of, let me help you understand why you should vote for this bill and why this is good for the people of Utah. Mm-hmm. Right. And they're like, okay, thanks. They want to do what's right. Like you said, they want to represent their people. They want to do what's right for the people of Utah. Absolutely. But I get that can be intimidating. So I think if we can figure out how to get athletic trainers over that hump. We've been working really hard on third-party reimbursement in Utah because I really believe it's huge for salaries. And we had to take a little break from it just for financial reasons. But, you know, I still, that's, to me, that's my life work. If I can get third-party reimbursement in Utah, that's my ultimate goal.
I think it's a great goal. It's going to be really important. I know it's one of our national initiatives as well that we're looking at doing.
Yeah, that's another thing that got me excited about being on the board when that just, and I talked to Kathy about that when she was running. I'm like, this has got to, she's like, oh, I get it, right? I said, this has got to be a priority. And she's like, you know, she ran a clinic for years. She totally gets it. So
let me ask you this, Valerie, talking about third-party reimbursement. Our settings are as unique as we are, right? So when you talk about third-party reimbursement, it really could look different for each setting, right? Like we're pretty familiar with the way it works in a clinic setting or a hospital-based mm-hmm. setting, but mm-hmm. how do you see third-party reimbursement impacting secondary schools, college, university, occupational health?
So that's tricky. You know, some have been billing in the college setting, and it doesn't work nearly as well in most situations as we thought it would, right? So if you think about if your insurance, right, if you go to the doctor where you are, you know, your insurance will pay for it. But if you're traveling and you're in Arizona and you go to the doctor, well, they'll only pay for it if it's an emergency. And outpatient rehabilitation is not an emergency, typically. A lot of what we do is not an emergency. And most athletes, you know, even at Weber State, are not from Ogden, right? They're not from the local area. So if you try to bill, we're all out of network. So you don't really get reimbursed nearly as much as you think you would. I mean, I think we had a group that came in, worked with Weber State and said, oh yeah, you know, you can bill for all your services. You're going to generate $100,000 a year. And they barely generated 10,000, and it created more problems than it solved, because the way it worked is the athletic trainers would put everything into the system, and the company we were working with was supposed to kind of filter and, you know, only send billable things to the insurance companies. But this company was actually sending everything. And it actually really hurt us when we were going through reimbursement efforts, because here we are trying to convince the legislature to allow third-party reimbursement. And we've got insurance companies saying, don't let athletic trainers bill. They don't know what they're doing. You know, we've had athletic trainers try to send us five treatments a day, 5 days a week for one patient. You know, we would never pay for that. And so in their mind, it made us look like we didn't know what we were doing. And in reality, it was just the company that the colleges were working with weren't filtering. They were just sending everything. And like so it's actually, it set us back probably 5-10 years, unfortunately. So I think if we do, and some of the colleges like Weber State have stopped billing because it wasn't generating any money and it was more hassle than it's worth. And so I think we have to be really careful about that. So when we go back to it, we really have to educate ourselves and make sure that we only bill for things that are truly billable, you know, only up through activities of daily living, only for treatments that are truly medically necessary. If we work with an outside company, we have to make sure they're really going to filter based on those parameters. And then I think in a high school, it can be tricky too. I know, you know, in a lot of high schools, the athletic trainer is the only healthcare provider that kid has access to. And so I fear that if we were to bill insurance in a high school setting, that some kids might think, well, I don't have insurance, so I'm not going to go to the athletic trainer. And that worries me a little bit. I think there could be settings where it makes sense, you know, but I wouldn't want kids to not come in because they don't have insurance.
Right.
And same with the college setting. I think you have to be careful not to deter somebody from seeking healthcare because they don't have insurance or they have a huge deductible. So you bill and then, you know, their family gets stuck with a big bill.
Even said though, Valerie, I mean, I think the important thing to take away from it is even if third-party reimbursement isn't the perfect fit for the AT's setting that's listening to this, that doesn't mean it's not an important initiative. It doesn't mean that we still don't need it, because although it may not fit exactly where you are working at the time, it still impacts you as a professional. It still has a direct connection to your way of life and to your success as a professional. So
right.
I think sometimes it gets missed in translation. I think sometimes ATs think, well, this isn't going to work where I am, so I'm not going to support it.
Right. And we talk about a rising tide lifts all boats, right? And, you know, we talk about it even, and I used to use the college example. I'm like, why do the faculty who work in the School of Business or Engineering, why do they get higher salaries than faculty in athletic training? Well, it's because out in the field, they could make more money, right? So they have an option to go to where they could make more money. And so even though they're not working in that option, they make more money in academia. And it's the same thing in a high school, right? Math and science teachers get higher salaries than English teachers. Why? Because they could go out in the world and make a ton of money. And so in order to get them into that job, you have to pay them more. So if all of a sudden there are jobs available for athletic trainers that pay a lot more, then maybe a high school has to raise their salary to compete to get somebody, because they could just leave and go work in an orthopedic setting and make 60 grand or, you know. So, I mean, that it's not going to happen overnight, right? But a rising tide will lift all boats.
Absolutely. And I do think we're starting to see it a little bit in the profession, right? Like we know We know things with hiring. We know there's a hiring shortage at places. We know that certain settings are getting impacted really hard with shortages of having employees in settings where other settings are doing great. So I think we're starting to see it, but it'll be interesting to see how it translates as we get further down this road.
Mm-hmm. It was a great year. I mean, I don't want there to be an athletic training shortage, but the reality is, if you look at other professions, that's when salaries finally went up. You know, if there's a teacher shortage, that's when salaries went up for teachers. When there was a nursing shortage, that's when salaries went up for nurses. And this year we happen to have an athletic trainer shortage for a variety of reasons. And I had a guy contact me from South Carolina and say, hey, if you have any students interested in this role, you know, it's a high school position, full-time in a high school, starting salary $50,000 with a $5,000 sign-on bonus, a $5,000 moving allowance. I mean, that was just unheard of. This is the first year I've ever seen sign-on bonuses. And again, I'm not going to go take that job, but it makes me so happy for our students. I'm like, yes, my students can go get a good job with a good salary, you know, and it's amazing, you know, and they can't even fill some of those positions. And it's forcing others, right, who didn't fill their positions. And they're like, well, I wasn't able to hire. And it's like, well, everybody else raised their salary. So if you want an athletic trainer, you better fight for a higher salary. Right. And, you know, I'm seeing it already. It's great. I think the trickle down is going to be huge.
Yeah, absolutely. Valerie, looking back over the course of your time from when you first became an athletic trainer to today, if you could go back and have a conversation with yourself at 25, what advice would you give her?
That is a good question. And I thought about this one, and I really don't know if I would do anything differently other than just say, hang in there. It gets better. I did my master's at University of Virginia. I was finishing up when I was 25, I think. And it was intense. You know, it was a one-year program. I took 17 credits a semester as a grad student. I traveled with two Division I teams, one in the fall, one in the spring, and did an invasive research thesis. And it was just, it was crazy. I went from 7 a.m. till 10 o'clock at night every day, and it was exhausting. And some days I questioned, like, can I really do this? But now I look back and I go, wow, I did that. Like, I did that. I can do this hard thing that's in front of me today.
Oh, absolutely. You know? I felt the same way. I'm like, you know what? Anything is now going to be easier than my last year of grad school. Cause that was, it was great. I wouldn't trade it for the world, but it was intense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I even do that with my students in our kind of opening session. Every time we have a new group and we do a get to know you, and I say, tell me about a hard thing you did in your life that you weren't sure if you could get it done, but you did it. You look back now and you're like, wow, I did that. And then I tell them, you know, they share all their stories, and I say, now I want you to reflect back, because this program is going to be hard. This program is going to challenge you. This program is going to stretch you. And sometimes you're going to think, I don't know if I can do it. And I want you to reflect back on that other thing that you did and say, hey, I did that. I can do this. So I think just encouraging myself to don't give up, keep going.
Valerie, let's talk a little bit more about professional burnout and career fatigue. There seems to be a pretty overwhelming sentiment among the profession right now regarding these two things. What would you say to those athletic trainers who may feel or questioning their longevity in the profession?
Yeah, I mean, it's real, and I get it. And honestly, it's one of the things I loved about teaching, and we went back to teaching, is that I was in control of my time. I probably worked just as many hours as I used to, but it's on my terms, as opposed to a coach or somebody else being in charge of my schedule. But I think there are things we can do to advocate for ourselves in athletic training. I had a friend in grad school, and at the university she was assigned to, every athletic trainer would sit in the athletic training room from 6 to 8 a.m. in case one of the athletes from their teams came in for treatments. And that's just insane, right? Like, you hired me. Don't you trust me to take care of your athletes too? And how about we make an appointment? You know, I mean, we do this. If you need to go to the eye doctor, you don't just walk in, right? Mm-hmm. You make an appointment, and they know you're coming, and they've got time set aside for you. And we cater so much to the athletes just to be there. And it doesn't really teach them in the end of the day. It doesn't teach them life skills. They think they can just walk into a healthcare provider's office without an appointment and be seen immediately, right? We should teach them how to make appointments. We should give them appointment reminders and we should hold them to it. And then we need to trust each other. I tell my students, I say, I want you to imagine that, you know, you leave here. We just got like 8 inches of snow. Imagine you just got in a nasty, icy car accident. Your life flighted to the emergency room. You're in intensive care. I mean, you were on like death's door. You're just hanging on by a hair, right? You get this team of surgeons and doctors taking care of you. And midnight rolls around. You know, what happens when there's a shift change? Do all those doctors and nurses stay in the hospital for 5 days straight because you're in such critical condition? And they're like, no. I'm like, oh, they do a shift change. I'm like, how can they do that? How can they hand over somebody who's so critically injured? How do they do that? And we have a conversation. It's like, well, good documentation and communication. And they talk to each other. And I'm like, okay, so tell me how we can't hand off a sprained ankle. And you just see the light bulbs go up. Like, oh my gosh, right? We're so in this mentality that I'm the only one who can take care of my athletes. Mm-hmm. And so I get that there's long hours and issues that there's, you know, some of it we can't do anything about, but there's a lot that we can do, right? By having more of a team effort, by scheduling appointments. One of the cool things I did when I was part of the CADI was doing accreditation site visits, and I got to visit other schools. And at California Baptist University, their staff don't sit at practice, right? So they timed their response time to every field and site on campus. And they said, look, coach, we can be at the baseball field in a minute and 30 seconds. Are you okay with that? Coach is like, yeah, fine. You can be in a minute and 30 seconds. You don't have to sit at practice. Great. And they did that with every coach. They timed it out. They just decided they would be at football because, you know, so many nasty things happen. Mm-hmm. And they would be at wrestling because it was like 2 miles away. Mm-hmm. But every other sport, they don't go. And so during practice time, all the athletic trainers are together in the athletic training room, you know, working as a team and doing rehab on the athletes who need it. So instead of doing rehab from 6 to 8 in the morning and then practice in the afternoon, right? They were just doing rehab during practice. So they had a much nicer work-life balance and they weren't always by themselves. They had a team. So if they're like, hey, you know what? I don't know what's going on with the shoulder. I've evaluated a rehab and it's not, what do you, you know?
It's a collaborative effort.
Yeah, Katie, you're the expert in shoulders. Why don't you take a look? Right. And they were so much happier. The staff were so, and the students got a great experience because instead of just sitting there watching practice, they were doing rehab and watching evals all day long and seeing the team work together. So there are ways that we can improve it for ourselves, but we have to advocate for ourselves. And that's when I talk about advocacy. It's not just legislative advocacy. We have to advocate for ourselves at work. We have to advocate for ourselves with our families. We have to advocate for ourselves everywhere.
And I think too, part of the challenge and feedback I always hear is, well, to make appointments, you have to get this fancy software. I don't have an appointment scheduler and things like that. And you really don't, right? There's so many free platforms that you can now tap into. I use Calendarly now. It's the greatest thing I've ever, we'll have to link it in the show notes because I honestly think it's the greatest thing that I have used this year as part of my toolbox. For me, the back and forth of like, hey, can you meet? Yeah, I can meet. When are you free? Here's when I'm free. What works? Just is a waste of time. Here's the link to my hyperlink to the bottom of my signature. It's got my live updated schedule. Find a time that works for you. Put it in there. And there's a live link. So your student athletes can use that link. Look at your schedule availability. Make the appointment. It's weird because you can actually, the free one only lets you set up one appointment. But if you, I think it's like $9 or $10 a month if you want to do the paid one. And you can do up to 3 different time slots. So you could customize it to how much time you need with the athlete and have them schedule it.
$120 a year. I mean, really, right? Like you just have to prioritize.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I love it. I've never personally thought of setting up facilities that way. And the more you're talking about it, my brain just is going everywhere because I mean, how cool would that be to be able to have that kind of setup?
Well, we keep saying we're healthcare providers. Well, let's do it like healthcare providers do it. Right? They have shifts, right? I know other organizations that they've said, yeah, we're going to do shifts, right? So this athlete, maybe you want to have the athletic training open all morning. Fine. So this athletic trainer works from 6 to 2. And then, you know, this other athletic trainer works from 2 to 8, right? Why not do shifts?
No, I think that's really great.
There's lots of ways to do it, but we have to trust each other And we have to be confident enough in our skills. I think a lot of times what an athletic trainer is worried about, and I know I felt like this way sometimes, well, like, what if I take Wednesday off and then Katie tapes my players and they like the way she tapes better, you know? Or what if I couldn't figure out what's going on their shoulder and then Katie figured it out, right? And so we get so self-conscious about that. And we just have to let it go. And we have to say, no, we're a healthcare team. And at the end of the day, if Katie tapes them better, then I'm going to say, Katie, show me how to do that. And I become a better athletic trainer. And at the end of the day, it's all about the patient, right? Does my patient get better care? And the answer is yes, because Katie figured out what's going on with their shoulder.
And believe it or not, that happens outside of athletic training all the time. I remember in the few times I've been at hospitals for various reasons, the nurses will shift off. I remember I was hospitalized when I had mono and I needed to have an IV switch. And my nurse was like, look, I could do this, but you really want my coworker to start your IV line. She's way better with the stick than I am. No problem. Go ahead. Yeah. I want the better stick. Trust me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we just, but you know, it's humbling to have to get to that place and to say that. Right. Mm-hmm. But if you keep the focus on not what's best for my ego, but what's best for my patient, then we all get some work-life balance.
Yeah. Valerie, as we wrap up, final thoughts for our audience today.
You know, I just think there's so many benefits to volunteering and getting involved and, you know, just throw your name in the hat, find something that interests you even a little bit and throw your name in. And it's so much fun. It really is. I mean, if you look at pictures of people, you know, after meetings, everybody's smiling and having a great time. And I won't tell you that everything I've ever volunteered with has just been a nonstop party. It's not. There's work and sometimes it's hard and sometimes we don't agree and sometimes it can get a little heated. But the majority of the time, it is so rewarding and it's so much fun. And you build your network in ways you would never imagine. But I just really enjoy it. You know, I think, you know, service is joy. It really is. It fills my cup. And give it a shot. Throw your name in the hat. And if you don't get picked the first time, just keep throwing your name in the hat. Don't give up. Just keep trying. And eventually you'll get picked. You will. And, you know, talk to somebody and tell them, I really want to get involved. And this is what I want to do. Come to your district director like me and let us help advocate for you and find a spot for you. And you won't regret it. You'll love it.
Valerie, thank you so much for your time today. This has been such a great conversation between talking about the profession, athletic training, research, volunteering, pathways to leadership, advocacy. I mean, we went all over the place, but it just was such a great conversation. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
For our listeners today, you can always send us feedback on new topics or questions you'd like us to ask our audience. You can reach us at engage@nata.org. You can also hit us up on a various social media channels. Make sure to go back to the show notes and look at all the different resources that we have posted from today's show. And as always, check back for our future episodes where we will continue to tap into our leaders and greats of the profession and learn more about their pathway to today. Until then, this is Katie Scott. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you at the next podcast. Have a great day.
Thanks for tuning in to Dedicated, a special series of the NATA cast. All resources mentioned during this episode can be found in the show notes or at nata.org/podcast. Listen, we want to hear from you. If you'd like to let us know what you thought or even what you want to hear in future episodes, send an email to the nata.org. And to make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the NATA cast and rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time.